Hi there, I'm Michal, and you're listening to the Rescue Tales podcast, the show dedicated to helping you settle your adopted rescue dog. In this episode, I chat with dog behaviorist Angie Cook about what leads dogs to become reactive or sensitive to other dogs and what you can do about it. We also discuss resource guarding. We chat about why it's so important to understand why your dog is resource guarding before trying to address the issue. Now, Angie has years of experience working with dog shelters, so we also talk about the key do's and don'ts of settling your adopted rescue dog. As always, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Hi, Angie, and thank you so much for joining me on the Rescue Tales podcast today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
We've been chatting a lot before we hit the record button. We've got all sorts of great topics to talk about today, from settling your adopted rescue dog to some of the challenges that people tend to face in the early, you know, days, weeks, and months. But before we get into that, tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do, and of course, who your dogs are as well.
Absolutely. So I am a certified dog behavior consultant and a certified family dog mediator, and I work at the Dog Door Behavior Center out of Asheville, North Carolina. And I have been doing this formally for about 5 years, but my background prior to this was rescue. I was the director of operations for a small rescue called Animal Compassion Network, and that we ended up merging with the larger Asheville Humane Society about 4 years into my tenure there. And then just because of some staffing shifts, I ended up becoming the director of operations for the Asheville Humane Society. And I oversaw the development of the behavior program at Asheville Humane Society. And that was one of the, you know, it's kind of the magnum opus of my career in rescue. It was really great to start the conversation about adopting rescue animals. That's something that we focused on. So we didn't just focus on what to do in the shelter with the dogs to help in as far as enriching their time in the shelter. That was something that we focused a great deal on, but we also focused a lot on just education with the adopters and helping them with their expectations around the dog that they were going to be adopting, the dog or cat that they were going to be adopting. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And then I live here in Weaverville, which is about 20 miles north of Asheville, with my wife and my son and our three dogs, Coda, who is an Australian Shepherd, and Izzy, who is a Chiweenie, and Bailey, he's just a Heinz 57. He's got all sorts of things in him. And yeah, we live on about an acre. We've got chickens and pigs, and the dogs have huge fenced in area, and they love it.
Super. Yeah. Well, you touched on a few really important points I wanted to pick up on there in your intro, one of which is working with adopters on kind of the education side of adopting a dog. And I think it'd be great just to kick off the conversation with, you know, maybe some of the misconceptions and mismanaged expectations people have when they adopt a rescue dog. Because I know I certainly had many, many, many when I adopted my dog Rosa, and I quickly, you know, was snapped back to reality when I brought her home and thought, okay, I'm a little bit in over my head, a lot of challenges. We managed to get through them really, really well, which is fantastic. But I wish I had education at my fingertips at the time. It's why I created the podcast, because I just felt like there wasn't a dedicated resource I could tap into post-adoption and throughout kind of that whole period of whether it's weeks or months or even up to a year, like we were saying, to settle an adopted, you know, rescue dog. So tell us about some of the kind of the expectations, misconceptions, and maybe some of the challenges that people will face when they're adopting a dog.
So I think one of the main things that people either forget or just don't really sort of think about is what the dog's experience has been from the time that they adopt prior. Okay. And so, you know, if you have an owner surrender, you have a dog that was in an established home, it was in an established social group, and for whatever reason, the dog needed to be rehomed. The dog woke up that morning, ate its breakfast, and got in the car thinking it was going somewhere else and ended up somewhere ended up at the shelter. Okay. And, you know, and this is not, I'm not saying this to pass judgment on anybody who has to relinquish their animal from to the shelter. This is just the dog's experience. And so now they're in this place where they don't know anything. It's a completely different environment from what they're accustomed to. Their people are gone. And I like to think about it as, you know, for people to really understand, where you're locked in a room and all you hear are other people screaming and yelling obscenities and panicked around you. Okay. And the dog's there for however long in this environment, and they, you know, they start forming relationships with the caretakers. And so that's something that they can kind of hang their hat on. And then all of a sudden this family comes and they play with them in a yard for 5, 10, 15 minutes. And they end up in another car and they go to another and completely different environment that they're not accustomed to. And they're either, you know, from the time that they've been at the shelter, they're so sort of stressed and, you know, pumped full of cortisol because of their time in the shelter, that we've got that, you know, that's why the 3 days of decompression, they've done studies and cortisol stays in the system for about 72 hours. So like, okay, you get a flushing of all the stress hormones that are in the dog system. And then they just sort of come to, and again, they're in a brand new environment with brand new people, with brand new expectations. And then they are who they are. And the expectations in the prior home or in the shelter may have been different than what they are in this new home. And so it's just something to remember, that your dog, the dog that you're getting from the shelter, has had a very kind of crazy upending experience for themselves, no matter what age they are. And coming into your home is not, I think a lot of times, you know, a lot of adopters I would talk to would be like, well, I'm taking them home. I've gotten them the nicest, most softest dog bed, and they're going to get this beautiful spot in the sunroom, and they can just bask in the sun, and we've got a big yard, and they're getting all these creature comforts, and that's great. But it's not like the dog's coming into this home and saying, oh, wow, great, what a fabulous new home I'm in. The dog's like, what the hell just happened to me? And what is happening to me? I don't know these people. I don't speak the same language as these people. I don't know what these people want. They're being inconsistent with what they're telling me. You know, there's all of these things going on for the dog, and the dog's just trying to figure it out. And so that's where we get a lot of the behavioral issues that we have, is the dog's just trying to figure it out. Yeah. Okay. And so just going into any adoption with the understanding that is kind of where your dog has been is a really great way. It's a touchstone for then hopefully being able to manage your expectations moving forward. So yes, there is absolutely a decompression time. The dog just is going to come home and probably want to sleep for 3 days to a week, you know, and they'll get up and they'll eat and they'll whatever, or their stress is manifested in just being insane, crazy, impulse, you know, like impulsive behaviors, jumping all over the place, jumping on the tables, taking, you know, like it can happen. You can see it in so many different ways, but that's what's happening, is they've got a ton of stress hormone in their body, and they're trying to find some kind of release. And so a lot of times I would see dogs returned within that 3 days because their go-to was being insane and, you know, chewing the screens and the sofa and all those things. And so just knowing that there's a very good chance that getting a rescue, like you could see some of those. And then also knowing, again, if a dog is whether a dog is an owner surrender or a stray, there's a reason that they kind of ended up there, you know, and some dogs just kind of wander away and that's what happens. And, you know, there is no underlying issue, but there's most likely, typically, well, there was an underlying issue that cause them to end up in the shelter anyway. And so then once that decompression period is over, you start to see that behavior emerge.
Yeah.
And just going into it with the expectation of, yeah, something might happen and we're ready to sort of, we're ready to take that on, you know, or we're not ready to take that on. You know, a lot of dogs that come from shelters, you were talking about how your dog ended up with separation anxiety. Some people just don't have the resources or the ability to take on separation anxiety. And so knowing what, you know, we would kind of coach our clients too, and knowing what your limits are with, you know, what's your deal breaker here when you do adopt the dog, and then also understanding the dog that you're adopting. And so a really great book, and I'm gonna send out a plug here for my colleague and mentor and very good friend, Kim Brophy, Get Meet Your Dog. It's one of the most comprehensive kind of just volumes that really synthesizes what you're getting with certain breed groups and what you're getting in general, the holistic dog. But if you're getting a herding dog or a hunting dog or a gun dog, or, you know, you want to know, especially if there's a very pronounced genetic resemblance to one of those groups, you want to know what you're getting. If you're getting a guardian breed, you need to know that the guardian breed is, you know, most likely at some point or other going to have feelings about people who come into your home, and setting up things, you know, whether it's seeking out a behavior consultant or a trainer to help that dog understand what that's about. And we were talking about that before we started recording. You know, I like to, you know, make the analogy of, you know, you go on Craigslist and you put out an ad for a roommate, and you get this roommate, and the roommate, you know, when we put out an ad for a roommate, you know, we interview them and we kind of try to see if our lifestyles are going to mesh up, but then they move in and all of a sudden, you know, they're messy, or they have lots of friends over, or, you know, like things start to emerge through our living together. And, you know, we don't automatically just say, you know, this is a horrible human being, and they, you know, that she's a bad girl, or he's a bad boy, you know, like, because he leaves the bathroom messy. What we do is we sit them down and we say, hey, this is how I like to live, and this is how you like to live, and let's figure out a way that we can compromise so that you're getting your needs met and I'm getting my needs met, and you formulate this understanding of how to live together, cohesively. And that's the same thing that we want to do with our dogs. Is you have this understanding of the world through, you know, your life experiences and your instincts and your genetics. I have this experience of the world. We're living together. Let me help you understand what the expectations are. And, you know, and that's what we do with family dog mediation. I love kind of how we work together, is we say, so this is what your dog actually needs. And so we're not just taking this dog and trying to fit them into this, you know, this round, you know, peg into this square hole of these people's lives, their expectations. We're taking this dog and saying, these are the things that they need. And let's figure out a way that we can compromise so that you can meet that need, so that, you know, you're getting your needs met and they're getting their needs met.
Yeah. No, I think, oh gosh, you've touched on so many important points there. And there's a couple of things I do want to unpick. So when you talk about the 3 days, I didn't realize it takes 3 days for the stress hormones to flush. That's a really interesting insight. But one thing I do want to clarify to listeners is, I'm assuming it's 3 days, provided you don't give the dog additional stress and it's not.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes,
I just want to make that really explicit.
No. And it's 3 days decompression. Yeah.
And decompression means if the dog needs space,
yes,
keep it space. So when I brought my dog Rosa home, I was telling you before we started recording, she basically just slept by the front door for the first few days. She refused to come inside. And I was like trying to, you know, encourage her with treats and come on, sweetie, come inside. And I've got these nice warm beds for you. And then 10 minutes into doing that, I'm like, she's not moved. I'm like, Neil, just go away. Just give her some space. And that worked. As soon as I gave her space, she started, but she just needed the space and the distance. So I just wanted to clarify that. And the other point you mentioned about, you know, people saying, oh, you've got this beautiful sun lounge for them and made up the slot, like me, you know, I've got used all these beds and toys and like naively thinking she's going to come in on day one and just, you know, lie down and be like, hey, you know, throw me a toy and let's have a treat and stuff. When I think back now, like, what was I even thinking? But I think one thing we sometimes don't realize is, especially as a first time dog companion, adopter, parent, is that we might think we're giving them a nicer environment, but I'm pretty sure, you know, just looking at some of the videos of Rosa, when my dog Rosa, when she was in a field with the puppies, apart from being hungry, she was probably quite content.
Yes.
I mean, if she absolutely had food in abundance, she probably would have been like, hey, I'm living the life. I'm running around, I'm free. And then I bring her into a building. Luckily, we have a really big balcony. So she gets, you know, and I take her out lots during the day. So she gets plenty of playtime. But just because we think it's a nice environment doesn't mean that's how they perceive or experience it. So I just wanted to call that out.
Yes, that is such a fabulous point, because most of the environments that we provide dogs are sort of counter to what would be an ideal environment for them. Even though they're getting all the creature comforts, they would prefer to be laying in a dirt hole somewhere, waiting for somebody to come by to bark. You know, like my dog Coda, we have more dog beds in this house than we have furniture for people to sit on, but her preferred place is this hole under a bush that she has dug, waiting for a neighbor to walk by so that she can tell them that they need to keep to move along. And then she goes right back to her hole. Like, that's where she wants to be. Yeah. You know, it's very, you know, like we just sort of project this ideal. This is obviously what they would want. You know, I have so many clients, they bring a new dog home and they have just gotten this beautiful dog bed and they put it in the crate. And the first night the dog just annihilates the dog bed and is laying on the plastic of the crate.
Yep.
The next night they go out and they get another dog bed. The dog just rips the dog bed to shreds and they're lying on the plastic of the crate. And then when they come to me and I say, you need to take the bed, you know, you need to take the bed out, because they don't want the bed. They just want to lay on the plastic of the crate. You know, they would probably actually prefer to be laying somewhere else, but because they're, you know, chewing up your couch while you're sleeping at night, we have to work with the crate here, but that's where they want to be. And they're like, what? Not have any bed at all? What about a towel? Like, you can let them chew your towels to bits and pieces. You can go through 15 towels if you want. But what your dog's telling you is they just want to lay on this hard surface, which is, you know, like that's what they want. But it's hard. It's so hard for us to make that connection. Yeah. I wouldn't want to lay on the floor. Yeah. Why would my dog want to lay on the floor?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I always think of what Andrew Hale talks about is what's the dog's emotional experience. And when I spoke to him, it was just such a wake up call for me to be thinking not about her emotional state, but her emotional experience. Because I really don't, I think if we asked ourselves the question, what is the dog's experience? What is the dog's perception?
Mm-hmm.
I think we would behave very, very, very differently with our dogs. And I think we wouldn't be as judgmental. And, you know, I saw a really good post by Andrew Hill on Facebook the other day, and he was like, what is behavior anyway? I'll link to it in the show notes of this episode.
And
he talks about how we're so quick to judge our dog's behavior, and, you know, Kim talks about this a lot, you know, no such thing as a bad dog. And I've reflected on that a lot when I think about, you know, my journey with my dog now. Over 5 months, 5 months ago I adopted her. She has eaten my shoes. She has, you know, pulled me down the street on the leash. She's chased rabbits in fields. She's eaten a live bird in front of me, which left me in tears. You know, she's she went through a phase where she was very sensitive to other dogs and would growl and lunge at them, all of these different things. When I think back, none of that was her being a bad dog. Right. All of that was her just being a dog. Just being a dog. I would strongly recommend anyone thinking about, or even if you have a dog and kind of struggling, read her book, because it's so accessible. She's taken so much research and condensed it into it's so easy to digest and understand. I was listening to it as an audio book. And when I listened to the chapter about sight hounds, I'm like, oh my God, this makes so much sense. Cause my dog is a sight hound. And it was just like pennies dropping. And absolutely such a great book. I will definitely link to that in the show notes, because I think that's a must read. I don't think we do, as you know, we do enough, especially as first time dog parents or adopters. I don't think we do anywhere near enough research, including myself. This is not me pointing fingers, including myself, when making the decision. I thought about how it would impact my lifestyle. Like, you know, knowing that I couldn't just pack a bag and go away for the weekend. Like, you know, I had a responsibility and, you know, just taking her out multiple times a day, making sure she's, you know, physically and mentally stimulated, that there are bills, all of that stuff. I thought through, I planned for that. But the other stuff, honestly, I didn't know what I didn't know, in a way. So yeah, sorry, I went off on a bit of a rant.
Well, no, that's a really great point too, because I mean, really up until Kim Brophy put that book out, there wasn't good information. It was information that people just thought were, you know, that our industry, so the pet industry, actually just sort of brushed aside as almost just superfluous. You know, like, it doesn't matter what the breed of the dog is. Those things don't matter. And as a result, as a consequence, there's just a lot of generic information. And so, you know, if you went to look up, you know, okay, so I'm looking at a sight hound here. What does that mean? Well, okay, I typed the breed in. This breed is very loyal. This breed is well trainable. Like, those are the sort of like the weird, generic, arbitrary, just kind of adjectives that the industry is throwing out about these dogs. And you're not getting a realistic understanding of the fact that if you have your dog out in a field and there is a releasing stimulus of either a dachshund or a rabbit, your dog is going to immediately initiate software that's going to make them run toward that thing. Yep. You know, like, that's just what's going to happen. Like, that's who she is. And so, you know, like, not having that information accessible has really put a lot of people at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And actually the program that we developed, Kim helped me develop that program at the Humane Society, was incorporating information about the breed groups for people when they did come to adopt. So they knew, you know, you're going to terrier. If this is a terrier, this is what a terrier is going to do. This is what it'll look like. And, you know what you've signed up for here. And not that breed or genetics is predictive. There are a lot of dogs that don't, especially when there is a mix, but just know that if you start to see that behavior, that this is why, and it's not that your dog's a bad dog. Yeah. It's that for hundreds, even sometimes thousands of years, we human beings have selected these dogs for this behavior. And this is why your dog is doing this thing.
Yeah.
Not because they're bad.
Yeah.
Because that's what we have wanted them to do. And now we've put them in an environment where we don't want them to do that anymore. And they're like, what the heck? That's what my instincts tell me to do, you know? And really, like, having that understanding, their behavior does not make them bad. Mm. Their behavior is what is what they, in some cases, what they've been designed to do, or in some cases, what we are inadvertently reinforcing them to do, or what the environment is telling them that they should do. There's all sorts of things that play into the manifestation of their emotional response, which is what Andrew Hale talks a lot about. Most of it is an emotional response. And that's the same thing. If you study the human brain and human behavior, most of our behavior that isn't sort of, you know, involuntary is the result of an emotional response. Same thing. you know, and we don't get the same labels put on our behavior because the pet industry, again, is sort of just made us think that these beings are just little robots that mm-hmm. we just hire a trainer and for, you know, $100 an hour, they're going to go in and type in some new algorithms and make your dog stop doing the things that they have been selected to do for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's beautifully said, Angie. And I think, you know, the part of the problem, and I think I was talking to Kim about this when we chatted on the podcast, is we live in a world where we expect instant gratification yes. and immediate results. And we kind of want to outsource a lot of the problems. Mm-hmm. Whereas many of the behavioral problems, I mean, the ones I've seen with my dog, I mean, is taking us months to work through them. There are yes. no quick fixes. And unfortunately, anything that seems to be a quick fix, you're just probably putting on Band-Aid on, you know, it's equivalent yes. to putting a Band-Aid on an affected wound and actually not really treating it the way it should be. And yeah, and I think that's a challenge. And I think back to when Rosa first came home and a lot of the challenges that we faced, I didn't bring in a trainer. The only time I brought in a trainer and behaviorist was when I saw she was sensitive to other dogs, because I felt mm-hmm. like I was in over my head. I'm like, I don't know how to deal with this. And the one thing I did learn was it was more about educating me than training her. And mm-hmm. it was educating me to think about, right, she is barking and lunging at these dogs. She's on a leash, right? Why is she doing that? Like, dogs don't enjoy doing that. It's not fun for them. She's right. clearly in a stressful state. Like, what's happening from her perspective? And thinking of it that way really helped me work with the trainer and behaviors to overcome that. And honestly, if you see her today, she's known in the dog park that she just loves every single dog she sees. She will play with, you know, a Great Dane to a Chihuahua. Like, she just gets uh-huh. along with all the dogs. And she's like, that's her reputation in the dog park, which is lovely. And when I say to him, like, this is a dog that a mere few months ago would have been lunging and barking and snarling at your dog, honestly, you would be like, you know, picking it up and running away. So it's just amazing how, just if we kind of flip it and just think from the dog's perspective,
yes.
and work with a professional, I think we need to really manage our expectations in terms of how long some of these challenges can take, and really just think from the dog's perspective. But on that note, I mean, I'm really keen to hear your views on kind of sensitivity to other dogs.
Absolutely.
And what people, you know, because I see so many people with this challenge. I'm lucky that we got over it within a couple of months, but I see people who you know, walking with their dogs, and you can see that they're both stressed out. Dog is stressed out, parent is stressed out. So yes. what advice would you give to someone in that situation?
So, I mean, the first thing would be to, you know, I mean, you just put that beautifully and really understand the perspective that the dog is having in that situation. I think a lot of people just see it as the dog being aggressive, and, you know, aggression equals bad, and or the dog trying to be dominant or protective. I mean, there's so many different labels that people put on dogs that are having sensitivity and reactivity with other dogs. Mm-hmm. And again, to the point you just made, it is 150% an emotional, it's just emotional response to seeing another dog and to being in that situation. And when you're working with a dog, a rescue, or even really just the dog that you've just recently, you know, started a relationship with, I just want to kind of make a point to that. What we are doing when we invite a dog into our homes is we are initiating a brand new relationship. Okay. And it is like any other relationship we have, where it, you know, we start a new relationship and there is, you know, there's just sort of the initial, just sort of cordial introductory, this is who I am, okay, this is who you are. And a big part of that decompression piece and that giving space is when we start a new relationship, some people do this, but most people don't, we don't go full tilt into, all right, let's just make out 24 hours a day. And like, we like, there's space given, right? Like, hey, let's get to know each other a little bit. Let's go on a couple of dates first and really, you know, suss this out. But what's really important is, just like in any relationship, it takes time to build trust. Okay. And when you have a creature that has had its trust violated, just like in a human relationship, when we have sort of our own baggage from past relationships, when you have a creature that has had its trust violated, their trust violated, it can take a little bit longer to build trust. And trust is integral to understanding expectations, and especially trust is integral. Trust in your human companion is integral to getting through sensitivity and reactivity to other dogs. Integral. If the dog does not feel like they can trust their human companion to handle the situation and help them and parent them through it, the dog is not going to be able to get through that situation.
Yeah.
Hands down, you know? And so having a brand new dog and having a dog that's reactive, you can do all sorts of counter conditioning and desensitization and do all that training.
Yeah.
But if the dog can't hang their hat on their human yet, then it's going to take a lot longer, because we're building that trust. It is the foundation of being able to get through the sensitivity and reactivity with other dogs. Because, this is how I explain reactivity. All right. So a lot of people know the piece that the leash is just sort of like, the dog's like, if I wasn't attached to you, I could be 4 states away in no time. But because I'm attached to you, I am much more vulnerable to this dog who is approaching me. So the leash just automatically puts that in. And I think that we've, you know, as you know, trainers and consultants in my industry, I think that we've started to do a really good job of helping that, to explain that to people. But understanding the sort of mechanics of what's happening and what is contributing to the emotional response that dog is having is, so dogs out in the wild, when they see each other, they prefer to sort of meet in a sort of like overarching or sort of sigh or, you know, coming up. They like to have a little bit more fluidity in how they meet and greet one another. But because we live in urban environments, the way we walk are on straight roads, and the dogs are walking right toward one another. And what happens when dogs walk directly toward one another is we're creating an agonistic conflict type vibe. Okay. So you've got your dog and you're walking down the road, and you know, your neighbor has their dog and they're walking down the road, and they're already on leashes, so they know they can't get away. And we're creating this situation that how they communicate is conflictual. So they're walking, and then they all of a sudden, you know, your dog starts throwing off signals to the other dog, you know, they start doing lookaways or, you know, some displacement behavior saying, hey, I don't want anything to do with this conflict. And the other dog's like, yeah, I don't either, but they still keep walking toward one another, which in the wild, they would, you know, in naturally, they would just sort of divert and move on. So basically they can't trust what the other dog's saying, because they just keep coming forward. So barring any other baggage that's happening for their dog with, you know, they've met another dog before on leash and that didn't go well, or they've been attacked by dogs, or like barring any other kind of negativity, or the other end of the spectrum where they are really excited by other dogs and they're frustrated and they want to get to the other dog, barring any of that, that particular situation is creating a stressful emotional response for them because they don't know how to navigate it because their natural ways of communicating with one another are, we have rendered them ineffectual. Okay. Yeah. And so then we have, you know, then we have this uproarious, you know, stop behavior where they're basically like, I've thrown out this signal. I've told you this. I've told you this. Now I need to tell you, you need to stop because I'm getting, this is stressing me out. And now they're lunging and barking at the other end of the leash. And they're like, to their human, they're like, what are you doing? I don't feel good about this. Are you not seeing the fact that I'm over here sniffing this blade of grass and I've stopped and scratched my neck a couple of times and I've done, you know, so all of these things are happening in this very like brief moment that we aren't aware of as, you know, as dog parents, because we don't understand the nuances of their communicating. So that's a big, big piece when we're talking about kind of the emotional response to the sensitivity. Your dog could have never had a bad experience with another dog, yet that scenario that we're putting them in every single day can create that same thing.
That blows my mind to think that the only part of that whole scenario that you just talked through that we actually recognize is when the dog started barking and lunging and growling, but we didn't read any of the other stuff that happened before that. And that head-on collision is really, you know, and seeing it and the point around, because I was going to ask you, like, when you say trusting, they need to be able to trust us, what that actually means in practice. And I'd assume that, you know, if you continue taking them down that road,
yes,
then all you're doing is eroding that trust.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's to that point, you know, and again, and that's what I do with my clients is we walk and I just start pointing out, okay, right here, you know, 75 feet away from the dog, this is when your dog is starting to tell you that they're feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That right there, that's uncomfort. That's discomfort. That's discomfort right there. Now they're starting to escalate because, and basically by the time I see them, I don't even see those signals unless we're a very, very far distance away because the dog has just learned, okay, they get me too close if I don't start doing this pretty.
Yeah.
So, like we walk through that. And then the trust piece is basically, yes, not putting them in that situation anymore, sort of moving them off to the side so that they can observe the dog and then putting my body and instructing the parent where to put their body in relationship to their dog to where their dog can feel like, even if that dog did start approaching, my person is going to manage manage the situation.
Yeah.
And we build up over time trust that my person is going to manage this situation. So even though I live in a world where I have to approach dogs this way sometimes, my person now understands how to help me feel the safest, how to position their body to make sure that I'm not having as much of a direct conflictual interaction with this dog, and how to read my cues early enough to know, yep, this is too much. Can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably one of the most insightful pieces of advice I've heard anyone give around sensitivity in dogs. Thank you for sharing. I think that's invaluable advice. And one of the other topics that I'm really, well, there's a ton I want to talk to you about, so I'm going to have you on the podcast again at some point.
Yeah, but I would love that.
For today, I'm really keen, and again, maybe like looking at it through the same lens as you talked about with sensitivity, is resource guarding. So I was, you know, mentioning before we started recording that my dog Rosa started to get, you know, a little bit precious about her toy Frisbee. She's fine with balls, even her squeaky balls that she loves. She's like, whatever, you know, dog takes it. It's like, knock yourself out, it's fine. But with this Frisbee, she started growling and starting to get very unhappy if any other dog comes anywhere near it. And my mother's dog, so that's kind of recycling a thing. My mother's dog is a cockapoo, and we get on very, very well. So when, you know, when I'm with her in London, we spend lots of quality time together. But what I've noticed recently is when I take her to the park, which, you know, I take several times a day when I am there, she will bark and lunge at any dog that comes anywhere near me. So I used to be able to, you know, play with her and other dogs, say hello to other dogs if they came up to me, give them a treat. And I'd always make sure I give them both a treat at the same time. Now she's not having any of that. So I know dogs will resource guard different things. Sometimes it's their food, people, toys, different things. So maybe help us understand, what is resource guarding from the dog's point of view? What's happening in terms of, you know, their emotional experience, their thoughts, all of that?
So resource guarding comes from just one of the, you know, kind of main biological imperatives of a dog, which is to obtain, or to obtain and maintain, you know, resources. And resources can be food or mates or social members or favored items. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that, like, that sort of biologically, that is what is happening for mm-hmm. them. And we have the same thing. You know, I think jealousy can kind of be, you know, if we have a friend and all of a sudden they're starting to hang out with somebody else a little bit more, we get a little resource guardy, don't we? We're like, well, wait, like, you're my friend. Like, we do coffee every Thursday. You want to bring this person in? No, like that's our time. Like, that's kind of, it's sort of the same flavor of, no, I don't, that doesn't feel good to me, because I feel threatened that this person might take you away from me or whatever. You know, we have all these sort of insecurities that fall into that. And dogs have the same thing. So, you know, they're like, you know, Rosa is like, this Frisbee is the coolest thing that I've ever had. And she has insecurity that another dog is going to take it and she may never see her Frisbee again, you know? And so in that way, she's telling the dog. So that's basically what resource guarding is, is I'm telling you that this is mine and I want this and you can't have it. And how that manifests is they're growling, they're showing teeth, they're sometimes air snapping, lunging, barking, sometimes even biting if we're not listening to the fact that they want this particular thing. Yeah. Now there are some resources where it's like, okay, cool. Like their food, for instance. You know, I try to explain to my clients, give me a scenario where when your dog is eating in the 3 to 5 minutes it takes them to eat, sometimes even shorter period of time, give me a scenario where you actually would need to take your dog's food away. Like a monsoon, you know, an alien invasion and we got to go. Like, is that, those are the only things that reasons I can think of where you would need to, in this very abbreviated time, take your dog's food away. So why are you trying to take your dog's food away? Like, why are we even creating this scenario? Your dog is enjoying their food. Just like if you gave me, you know, a plate of French fries, I would be eating it. And if you took it away, I'd be mad. And I would say, why did you take my French fries? That's what they're saying when they're growling at you. Why did you just take my food away? And then if you keep doing it, just like if you just kept taking my French fries, I would escalate. Stop taking my French fries. I'm eating. And so that's how they know how to communicate.
Yeah.
But because that is, you know, in kind of our lexicon, growling and showing teeth and things like that, it's scary. Because it does lead to other forms of physical harm to us, we then deem that as a bad behavior, as opposed to, oh, you're just communicating to me that feels uncomfortable. Okay, great. I'll stop doing that. So in those situations, like, let's just not even make it an issue. Stop trying to take their stuff. But in the issue, like with Rosa, if you're out playing with Frisbee with her and she growls at another dog, that could create conflict with the other dog and could put her in a situation where she might be harmed, you know? So, you know, what we do with that is we try to work with the emotional response that she's having, the fear that that dog is going to somehow take away her toy and she's never going to see it again, or, you know, or whatever's happening for her. There's insecurity and fear around all of it, but understanding that that's where it's coming from. And like with your mother's cockapoo, like it's probably not great for her to be doing that when there are other with other dogs, because it could create conflict that could put her in a position to be harmed. And so we then want to, you know, take a step back and say, okay, why are you doing this? What, you know, what's the concern here? And then start addressing that concern, you know, as opposed to kind of, which you're not doing, but like where other people would say, wow, she's just like, she's just being really, really bad. And I'm going to, you know, don't do that. You know, it's like, okay, there is an insecurity in you that something is going to result from this particular interaction. And I need to find the root of that insecurity and help address that particular insecurity.
So on that note, because I was doing a bit of, well, trying to do some research when I noticed my mom's cockapoo, her name's Lulu, doing, you know, with this new behavior. And one of the things I kept coming across is that sometimes it happens if a particular human is spending a lot of time, and I felt really bad because I felt it was my fault, because when I do visit them, she's like my shadow. She is literally like my shadow auntie. She does not leave me alone. Like, she doesn't want to interact with anyone else in the house when I'm there. She just follows. She sleeps in my arms in the bed, like her neck, like she's just literally cuddled up to me, right? And of course I absolutely love it, right? And then I'm like, oh my god, have I done this? So is that, so my question is, you know, can that be a cause, is that we, as you know, the human, have kind of made ourselves their world in a way that they, and can that contribute to resource guarding a person?
Yes, because there's this amazing thing, and you can check out the study on oxytocin and aggression. So basically, like, you and Lulu, like, are having this just like beautiful, just like luscious oxytocin bath with one another. Like, you're in this oxytocin loop where you're like, ooh, just cuddle with me and we're just gonna, I love it. And she's like, oh, I love you. And it's just like, and so you get into this thing where she is just feeling like she is just drowning in oxytocin. And so they have found in studies, there is a direct correlation with aggression and oxytocin, where it's just like, there is so much love, just like kind of the jealousy with the friend, you know, like, oh, I love it when we get together and you really hear what I'm saying and I hear what you're saying, and you want her to come and hang out with us? No, this is our time. You know, it's the same thing. Except Lulu shows it, you know, you have words to say, I don't like that. That doesn't make me feel comfortable. Like, you hang out with that person on your own. She's like, dog out. Get out of here. This, you know, like, she's mine. She's mine. And so that absolutely can contribute. Not that you've done anything wrong. You and this dog just have a really sweet relationship where she's just feeling an immense amount of love and oxytocin, feel good, and doesn't want anybody else encroaching on that.
That, you know what? That is just, I love anything that, you know, You have to send the link of that study to me so I can add that to the show notes, Angie, because I think that's just fascinating. And it makes so much sense, because I do have a really special relationship with Lulu, really special. And I almost feel the oxytocin when I'm, when I'm with her. And it's a very different relationship than what I have with Rosa, the different dogs. It would be different relationships. So that's, I just think that's really, really fascinating. I love a good study to explain some of the behaviors that we just kind of make assumptions around, but
Yeah. Well, and that's why, you know, the sciences are so important when we're talking about our dogs and understanding our dogs. You know, it's not, again, it's not that she's just being, you know, this aggressively, you know, bad dog. It's that she's having this emotional experience just like we do. And she doesn't, you know, she's feeling insecure about this particular experience. And then, and so then once we understand that, we can say, oh, Lulu, I am so sorry. So first of all, none of these dogs hold a candle to you. All right. Like you, me, you and me, you know, and when we're out in public, it is going to be to your advantage to understand that that's not something that you need to do. And so I'm going to hold your hand through any of these experiences so that you understand we're good. I love you dearly, but I'm going to pet this other dog.
Yeah.
It's going to be okay. You know, and that's how, that's how we get through helping her to, and what can happen with resource guarding is, again, if the underlying emotional concern is not addressed, what ends up happening is just like with us, some of the antecedents or the conditions that lead up to that interaction can then start creating the same emotional response. Then we just start seeing, now a dog's 15 feet away and they actually have no intention of saying hi to me, but I'm still going to bark ferociously at them because I need them to know that this is, you know, it's your mom's dog. So you're her sister. This is my sister. You know, I do that all the time. Like, so the dog is actually your uncle because it's your, you know, it's your grandparents, you know, but you know, she's mine. You need to stay away. And it's just like, no, it's okay. Easy peasy. You and I, like, again, this dog is just going to come and go. I'm just going to say hi to it. You don't need to worry about it. Everything's fine. And so it's really a huge part of what we do in family dog mediation is we are addressing the why.
Yeah.
Why is this happening? And that is just something that hasn't happened a lot in our industry. Trainers see a behavior and say, what can I do to modify this behavior? Yeah. And I want to know, why is the behavior happening? Mm. Is there an underlying emotional issue? Is there baggage from the past? Are you accidentally doing something that's reinforcing this behavior? Like, what's happening? What's going on? Is there something genetic that's going on? Is there something medical that's going on? Yeah. What's happening? Mm. Okay, now let's address that before we even start talking about how to explain to them a more effective way to get their needs met.
Yeah. No, I think that's just, it's so important. And I think I really, really do hope that more and more people, you know, will opt for mediation rather than and explore it, right? Rather than going straight for your standard kind of operant training. I found it eye-opening. I really, really have. And I think there's a discomfort as well with, you don't get the answer. You know, it's not like, here, let's just try desensitizer some treats or whatever. You don't really get an answer. It's a discovery process and you kind of figure it out as you go.
Yes.
And I think sometimes that's really uncomfortable for people because as human beings, we want answers and we want clarity and we don't like uncertainty and we don't like knowing how long things will take or, you know, when they'll be resolved and what that might look like. And, you know, which is probably why the opera model is so popular because, you know, sit, stay, whatever other command, they're just straightforward and you've ticked a box and you move on to the next thing. Yeah, so
you get your results.
I know people who have dogs who've, you know, been through multiple trainers and behaviorists over like periods of, you know, 7-8 years and they still have the same problems. And I'm like, well, maybe now you just need a radically different approach. This has just been an incredible conversation, Angie. I'd absolutely love to have you on again because I could just chat
I'd love
you
to.
Absolutely. Hours. Maybe you and Kim at the same time.
Like, that would be
fun.
That would be like the greatest geek out session ever.
But in the meantime, where can people find out more about you and your services?
They can go to Dog Door Canine Behavioral Services. Just Google that. We have our website, and there's all sorts of fun stuff about me and what we're doing as far as family with family dog mediation and kind of our whole take on human dog relationships. Or, you know, we're also on Facebook too. You can check us out at the Dog Door. And as family dog mediation picks up, and we, you know, and it is, so it's amazing. I just love it. It's like a wildfire that's just spreading. It's beautiful. We'll have more information about that too. But for right now, just go to the Dog Door behavioral services and check us out.
Super. I will link to those in the show notes.
Yeah. Perfect. And I'll look for that study too. Please,
that'd be fantastic. And I will also link to Kim's book in the show notes. Yes. And if there's any other resources that you think would be handy, just ping them over.
I will. Absolutely.
Angie,
it's been so great. Thank you
so much. Thanks a ton. Yeah.